This is Lecture 2 in the series Wealth, Natural Resources, and the Environment, and the Political Concept of Monopoly.
Well, good morning, ladies and gentlemen. I'm going to start promptly at least 9:01, which is now. Well, for the benefit of everyone here who has some familiarity with economics, it is necessary for me to show that the principle that man's desire for wealth is limitless is fully consistent with the law of diminishing marginal utility, which, of course, is one of the most important and well-known principles of economics, of sound economics. The law of diminishing marginal utility states that the utility, or equivalently, the importance or personal value that an individual attaches to a unit of any good diminishes as the quantity of the good in his possession increases. The law of diminishing marginal utility follows from the fact that goods have the power to satisfy wants. As a result of this fact, successive units of a good that are used to satisfy a want necessarily encounter wants that are more and more satisfied. For example, if I am very thirsty, the first glass of water I drink meets a very intense need. But that glass of water helps to satisfy the need. The second glass of water I drink, therefore, goes to serve a need that is less urgent precisely because it is already partly satisfied by virtue of the first glass of water. One reason for the consistency between the law of diminishing marginal utility and the limitless need for wealth is the elementary fact that the total utility of a person's supply of wealth must go on increasing so long as wealth has any positive marginal utility to him, whatever. For example, the fact that a second pair of shoes has a lower marginal utility to a person than his first pair does not contradict the fact that two pairs of shoes together have a greater total utility to him than one, and thus that it is better for him to own two pairs than one. So long as additional wealth has any marginal utility whatever, there is need for more wealth. Furthermore, it should be realized that the very process of increasing the amount of wealth that is available to the average member of any society entails the opening up of new uses for additional wealth, which has the effect of increasing the marginal utility of additional units of wealth compared with what they would otherwise be. The opening up of new uses for wealth occurs because essential to the ability to increase the supply of wealth is scientific and technological progress, which makes possible not only improved methods of producing goods of the kind that already exist, but also brand new kinds of goods. Thus, for example, the invention of the electric motor and the internal combustion engine, which radically increased our ability to produce and enjoy wealth, did not result in our sating ourselves with a vastly increased production of such goods as candles and ox carts. On the contrary, as part of the same process of improvement, these inventions were accompanied by the invention of the electric light and all the electrical appliances, and of course the automobile. In this way, increases in the ability to produce raise the marginal utility of additional wealth, along with providing the additional wealth. Thus, an automobile represents perhaps 100 or 1,000 times the wealth represented by an ox cart, and at the same time is probably of correspondingly greater marginal utility than an ox cart. Certainly, the marginal utility of a second automobile does not represent a drop in the marginal utility of wealth to the point that would correspond to the possession of a second 100 or 1,000 ox carts. Along the same lines, one might think of a 200 horsepower automobile as representing the material equivalent of 200 horses. Wealth representing a 200th part of an automobile has a higher marginal utility to the owner of an automobile than would the wealth representing a 200th horse. Thus, the effect of a growing ability to produce is not only more wealth, but also a higher marginal utility of the additional wealth in comparison with what it otherwise would have been if somehow the additional wealth had been able to come into existence without such technological advances. And as these examples imply, the effect of a growing ability to produce is a tendency toward an increase in the size of the marginal unit of wealth as well. This last point requires elaboration. The size of the marginal unit is never something fixed and immutable. It is always a matter of context, and the context is always the circumstances and conditions with which the individual is confronted. If, for example, the owner of two pairs of shoes has them stored in the same place, and that place is threatened with damage, what would be at stake for him would be the importance of satisfying the wants dependent on the two pairs together. The two pairs together would have to be evaluated, and they together would constitute the marginal unit. As von Mises once said to me in conversation, the marginal unit is whatever is the amount under consideration. As people grow richer, the size of the marginal unit tends to increase. Not only do they deal with things like automobiles instead of ox carts, but richer people deal with Cadillac or Mercedes-level automobiles rather than Chevrolet or Toyota-level automobiles. When differences in quality are considered, a house, a suit, or a dress, or a restaurant meal, practically everything tends to be a larger-sized unit of wealth for a richer person than for a poorer person. When this is taken into account, it becomes clear that it is a great mistake to assume that as wealth increases, the utility of the marginal units actually dealt with diminishes. On the contrary, the utility of these units actually increases. Unit for unit, a Cadillac has a higher marginal utility than a Chevrolet. A large, luxurious house has a higher marginal utility than a small, modest house, and so on. Furthermore, the fact that the utility of a marginal unit of wealth of given size diminishes as the quantity of wealth available to us increases is actually an important aspect of the desirability of increasing our wealth. What we rationally want is to be in a position in which the marginal utility of a unit of wealth of any given size more and more approaches zero, while what we deal with more and more is progressively larger sized units of wealth. We want to be in a position in which the loss of wealth represented by $10, say, is absolutely unimportant to us. Better still, in which the loss of wealth represented by $100, $1,000, or $10,000 is absolutely unimportant to us. The loss of wealth represented by $10 will be unimportant to us when we are rich enough to afford spending $50 or $100 for a single fine meal rather than $10 for a whole day's food. When, in other words, $50 or $100 replaces $10 as the representative of a marginal unit of food. The loss of $1,000 will be unimportant to us when we can afford to spend $50,000 for a second automobile, perhaps, rather than just $1,000 for our one and only ancient used car. The loss of $10,000 will be unimportant to us when we can afford to spend $1 million for our second or third home, rather than just $10,000 for our one and only small used trailer. Thus, we rationally want more wealth in order to be able to deal with marginal units of wealth of progressively larger size, and to be less and less concerned with units of wealth of any given size. In the spirit of the welcoming party allegedly once given by American millionaires to the famous 19th century English defender of capitalism, Herbert Spencer, the symbolic ideal is to be able to afford to use $100 bills to light one's cigar while dealing with mansions, yachts, and private railway cars as the significant marginal units of one's life. I turn now to the fact that under capitalism, the existence of a limitless need for wealth transforms the concept of scarcity from one whose meaning is deprivation into one whose meaning is growing abundance in the face of the fact that no matter how much men have, they desire and are free to produce still more. Man's limitless need for wealth, combined with the respective natures of desires and goods, is responsible for the fact that the desire to consume always far outstrips the ability to produce. Desires are mental phenomena based on thoughts and concepts. Goods are physical phenomena, requiring for their existence the performance of human labor. For all practical purposes, the referents of concepts are limitless, and to desire, one need do hardly more than imagine. But goods are always specific concretes, and each must be produced, requiring labor and effort. In essence, our desires outstrip our ability to produce by virtue of the fact that the range of our imaginations is greater than the power of our arms. Economists almost universally describe the condition in which the desire for wealth exceeds the amount of wealth available as one of scarcity. Scarcity, they hold, means any limitation of wealth relative to the need or desire for wealth, irrespective of whether the limitation proceeds from the lack of wealth or the abundance of desires. If one wishes to retain this terminology, one must say that capitalism radically transforms the nature of scarcity. For the people of pre-capitalistic societies, scarcity means a deficiency of wealth relative to urgent biological needs. It means supplies of food insufficient to still hunger, supplies of shelter and clothing insufficient to provide protection from the elements. Under capitalism, on the other hand, scarcity does not mean any such deficiency of wealth, but a vast and growing supply of wealth that lags behind the desire for wealth, a desire that always exceeds it, always grows as it grows, and that provides the impetus for its further growth. Scarcity under capitalism actually means economic ambitiousness and is the cause of the elimination of scarcity in the urgent biological sense. For example, under capitalism, the scarcity of food quickly ceases to mean starvation, but becomes instead a situation in which grain supplies have become abundant, but the point has not yet been reached where people can have all the meat they want. And then it ceases to mean even a deficiency of meat, but the fact that not enough of the meat supply is in the form of sirloin steak, and so on. Similarly, a scarcity of housing quickly comes to mean not a scarcity of dwelling space as such, but only a scarcity of ever more improved, more solidly constructed, and more luxurious dwelling space. At each stage, the desire to advance to a higher stage makes the threat to urgent biological needs more remote. In a country in which the scarcity of food is merely a scarcity of meat, a year of bad crops does not threaten famine. It just means that less grain will be devoted to feeding meat animals, and people will end up with less meat. In a country in which the scarcity of food means a scarcity of sirloin steak, a year of bad crops means that people will have to switch to somewhat poorer cuts of meat, as they utilize a smaller but still abundant supply of meat animals more fully for human consumption. And as a general principle, cutting across all branches of production, the growing abundance of supplies in a capitalist society steadily prolongs and enriches human life at the same time that it further and further removes such direct threats to human life as famine and plague. Evidence for the truth of this proposition can be found in the fact that hardly anyone dies from hurricanes, tornadoes, volcanoes, earthquakes, or contagious diseases in the United States, while large numbers do so in the poor and backward countries. Our better record is the result of our greater progress in wealth, in the form of such things as better constructed buildings, better means of transportation, and better medical facilities, as well as a more abundant and varied food supply. A recent illustration is the devastating storms which occurred in Bangladesh. Had the same storms occurred in a more prosperous country, in which people could afford concrete houses instead of thatched huts, and in which adequate seawalls could be built, the death toll would have been in the hundreds rather than over 100,000. I refer you to the story in the New York Times of May 11th of this year called Even in Bangladesh's Storms, Poverty is Underlying Killer. Nevertheless, no matter how productive and rich we become, scarcity, in quotes, always remains, for no matter how much we may increase the power of our arms by the application of machinery and tools, the range of our imaginations always remains far greater. This is because the range of our imaginations is enhanced by virtue of the same process of improving thought and knowledge that makes possible the machines and tools. For example, as already mentioned, the invention of the electric motor and the internal combustion engine did not result in our sating ourselves with a vastly increased production of candles and ox carts, but as part of the same process was accompanied by all the electrical appliances and automobiles. Thus, the desire for goods grew with the ability to produce them. It will continue to grow with further improvements in the ability to produce. If, to take an extreme example, the day should ever come when radical advances in technology make it physically possible for us to be sated with things like today's automobiles, the same radical advances in technology will open up the possibility of producing things like personal rocket ships and vacation homes on the moon. Thus, the desire for goods will always remain greater than the ability to produce them. Now, it should be obvious that a limitless need for wealth based on man's nature as a rational being implies the existence of an ineradicable scarcity of human labor, that is, of human productive ability. This fundamental scarcity of human productive ability in turn gives rise to the fundamental economic problem, which is how continuously to raise the productivity of labor. That is the output per unit of labor. The ongoing solution to this problem is, of course, the division of labor and capitalism. The division of labor and capitalism continually raise the productivity of labor to new heights. They are the essential social and political foundation for continuous economic progress. The implications of the scarcity of labor and the means by which the division of labor and capitalism are the solution to the economic problem is an enormous subject comprising the greater part of economics. I will not attempt to consider it here. Here, my assignment is to explain why the possibility of continuous economic progress is not prevented by any inherent lack of natural resources. I have already done this in my book, The Government Against the Economy, the relevant section from which you have presumably already read. Rather than repeat what I have said there, I will simply touch upon the highlights and attempt to state the essential principles more abstractly. The supply of natural resources provided by nature is one and the same with the supply of matter in all of its elemental forms, and of energy in all of its fundamental forms. It is coextensive with the entire mass of the earth and all the energy it contains, and indeed with the entire mass of the universe and all the energy it contains. For all practical purposes, the contribution of nature to the physical stuff of natural resources can be taken as infinite. Yet at the same time, nature does not provide a single particle of natural resources in the form of wealth. The bestowal of the character of economic goods and wealth on what nature provides is the work of human intelligence. An essential economic task of man is progressively to apply his intelligence to achieve a growing understanding of nature, and to build progressively more powerful forms of capital equipment that give him growing physical mastery over nature. Advances both in knowledge and in capital equipment themselves set the stage for further advances in knowledge and capital equipment. thereby operating to give man both ever greater understanding and ever greater physical power over nature. Provided, of course, that he continues to be rational, that is, continues to think and to act long range. For example, learning arithmetic sets the stage for learning algebra, which in turn sets the stage for learning calculus, and so on. Being able to build the first primitive railroads and steel mills provides the physical capacity for being able to build more and better railroads and steel mills later on. Developing a metallurgical industry sets the stage for developing an electrical industry and appliance industry, which sets the stage for developing an electronics and computer industry, which in turn sets the stage for developing a capacity to launch spaceships, and so on. The combination of increasing knowledge and increasing physical capacities bring a growing fraction of the physical mass of the Earth, and indeed the universe, more and more within man's power to serve his ends, and thus continually enlarge the fraction of nature that represents economically usable natural resources and thus wealth. The supply of economically usable natural resources is increased not only by the discovery of uses for things previously thought to have no uses, or new and additional uses for things already known to have uses, but also by advances that enable man to improve his access to things. For example, to mine at greater depths with less effort, to move greater masses of earth with less effort, to break down compounds previously beyond his power, or to do so with less effort, to gain access to regions of the earth previously inaccessible, or to improve his access to regions already accessible. All of these increase the supply of economically usable natural resources. All of them, at the same time, of course, bestow the character of goods and wealth on what had before been mere things. Today, as the result of such advances, the supply of economically usable natural resources is enormously greater than it was at the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, or even just one or two generations ago. Today, man can more easily mine at a depth of 1,000 feet than he could in the past at a depth of 10 feet, thanks to such advances as mechanical power, drilling equipment, high explosives, steel structural supports for mine shafts, and modern pumps and engines. Today, a single worker operating a bulldozer or a steam shovel can move far more earth than hundreds of workers in the past using hand shovels. Advances in reduction methods have made it possible to obtain pure ore from compounds previously either altogether impossible to work with or at least too costly to work with. Improvements in shipping, railroad building, and highway construction have made possible low-cost access to high-grade mineral deposits in regions previously inaccessible or too costly to exploit. Similarly, the development of chemical fertilizers and low-cost methods of irrigation have enabled man not only radically to improve the productivity of arable land, but actually to make more arable land. Today, land previously desert or semi-desert has been made vastly more productive than the very best lands available to previous generations. Israel and California provide leading examples. There is no limit to the further advances that are possible. Hydrogen, the most abundant element in the universe, may turn out to be an economical source of fuel in the future. Atomic and hydrogen explosives, lasers, satellite detection systems, and indeed even space travel itself open up limitless new possibilities for increasing the supply of economically usable mineral supplies. Advances in mining technology that would make it possible to mine economically at a depth of, say, 10,000 feet instead of the present much more limited depths, or to mine beneath the oceans, would so increase the portion of the Earth's mass accessible to man that all previous supplies of accessible minerals would appear insignificant by comparison. And even at 10,000 feet, man would still quite literally just be scratching the surface, because the radius of the Earth extends to a depth of 4,000 miles. Thus, the portion of nature that represents wealth should be understood as a tiny fraction that began as zero, and even though it has since been multiplied by several thousand fold, is still virtually zero when one considers how small is the portion of the mass of the earth, let alone of the universe, that is subject to man's control. To borrow and expand upon Ayn Rand's statement that the good is an aspect of reality in relation to man, for all practical purposes, nature in its infinity will forever remain something far more of whose good in relation to man remains to be discovered and achieved than has ever been discovered and achieved, with the essential requirements for the of the ongoing process being reason and capitalism. Reason and capitalism achieve a progressive enlargement of the goods and wealth character of nature, and thus a continually increasing supply of economically usable natural resources. So long as men preserve a division of labor capitalist society and are free and motivated to think and build for the future, the body of scientific and technological knowledge at the disposal of mankind will grow from generation to generation, as will the supply of capital equipment. On this basis, man can steadily expand his physical power over the world and thus enjoy an ever greater supply of economically usable natural resources. There is no reason why, under the continued existence of a free and rational society, the supply of such natural resources should not go on growing as rapidly as in the past, or even more rapidly. The ultimate key to the economic availability of natural resources is motivated human intelligence, which means a capitalist society. In such a society, large numbers of the most intelligent people devote their lives to science, technology, and business. All are highly motivated to increase the supply of economically usable natural resources by the prospect of earning a personal fortune for every significant success they achieve in this regard. No greater guarantee of mankind's ability to enjoy a growing supply of natural resources could be found. The underlying metaphysics of a virtually infinite nature that is confronted by motivated human intelligence ensure that no greater guarantee of success is necessary. There has been much talk about an energy shortage. There is obviously no shortage of energy in nature and no inherent reason why mankind should not be able to continue the progress of the last two centuries and gain economical access to more and more of nature's virtually infinite supply of energy. For an analysis of the actual nature and causes of the energy crisis of the 1970s, I refer you to my book, The Government Against the Economy. I must point out, again, for the benefit of everyone here who is familiar with economics, that the proposition that there is no practical limit to the potential supply of economically usable natural resources is in no way contradicted by the law of diminishing returns. Like the law of diminishing marginal utility, it too is a well-established and sound principle of economics. The law of diminishing returns states that under a given state of technological knowledge, the use of successively larger quantities of any factor of production or combination of factors of production in conjunction with a fixed quantity of any other necessary factor or factors of production eventually results in less than proportionate increases in output. For example, a continuous doubling and redoubling of the labor and capital applied to a given piece of land must eventually yield less than double the output. There is no contradiction between the law of diminishing returns. There's no contradiction between the law of diminishing returns and the potential for infinite expansion in the supply of natural resources, because the law of diminishing returns applies only at any given time in the context of a given state of technology and capital equipment. over time, economic progress can occur. Indeed, in a division of labor, capitalist society, with its rationality and its incentives, both monetary and cultural, for the continuous application of reason to the problems of human life, economic progress is the norm. The advancing technology and improving capital equipment which such a society makes possible can easily offset the effects of the law of diminishing returns, and by a wide margin. It continues to be true, of course, that, for example, one can bake only just so much bread of a given quality from a given quantity of flour, or generate just so much heat from a pound of coal. However, ways are found for the same quantity of human labor, using improved machinery or equipment, to produce and process larger quantities of flour, coal, and all other goods. Similarly, ways are found for the same quantity of human labor to farm or mine larger quantities of land, and to render larger quantities of land suitable for farming or mining. This occurs through such means as the use of tractors and steam shovels, improvements in transportation, and the development of improved methods of irrigation, and the discovery and improvement of high explosives. In addition, as scientific and technological knowledge increases, ways are found radically to increase the productive power of each acre of farmland or mineral deposit. In farming, this occurs by such means as improving the chemical composition of the soil, the use of insecticides and herbicides, and developing improved strains of seed. In mining, it occurs by such means as finding ways to process ores previously impossible to process or too costly to process, such as acquiring an ability to move multi-ton loads of ore with less effort than was previously required to move a single shovelful of ore, and by such means as learning to break elements out of different compounds or to do so at a lower cost. For example, learning how to break iron out of sulfide compounds as well as oxide compounds, and to do so at a lower cost. Thus, in a division of labor capitalist society, an expanded use of land encounters diminishing returns whether in 1891 or in 1991. But in such a society, by 1991, economic progress has so improved the productive powers of human labor that the very poorest lands and mines currently in use are 100 times more productive than the very best lands and mines in use in 1891. And the point to which the productivity of labor diminishes in agriculture and mining in 1991 is more than 100 times higher than the point to which it diminished in 1891. Indeed, thanks to economic progress, it is possible today to take even extremely submarginal land, actual desert, and by piping in water and adding various chemicals to the soil, make such land vastly more productive than were the very best lands of a few generations ago, as has been accomplished, as I've indicated, in Israel and the Imperial Valley in California. Similar examples can be found in the case of mining. Indeed, so great has been the access to better lands and the increase in yields per acre on all grades of land that extensive acreages farmed in the past have been thrown out of cultivation and returned to forest or pasture. This was the case in large portions of the eastern United States as better lands opened up in the Midwest, and in Great Britain as American lands became a source of supply. With still further economic progress, such results will continue to be achieved in the future. For example, in recent years, it has been demonstrated that it is even possible to grow many crops in scientifically controlled soils and solutions in multi-story buildings, in virtual factory conditions. This, of course, is a development potentially equivalent to a practically limitless increase in the supply of agricultural land. The art of genetic engineering, presently in its infancy, also holds out enormous potential. In the case of mining, it will probably one day be possible, with the aid of controlled atomic and hydrogen explosions, to move the most enormous masses of Earth at a minimum of cost. and it will probably come within man's power someday to conduct mining and even farming operations, not only under the sea, but elsewhere in the solar system and beyond. Thus, the leading principle continues to be that as man increases his knowledge of and physical power over the world, indeed the universe, the supply of accessible and economically usable natural resources continues to increase and to increase per unit of labor expended. I want to point out that the existence of the law of diminishing returns implies that economic progress is necessary not only for improvement in the standard of living, but also to maintain the standard of living at any given level. In the absence of economic progress, a rising population would result in diminishing returns in both agriculture and mining, because the larger supply of foodstuffs and minerals that would be required for the larger population would necessitate resorting to land and mines too poor to have been exploited before, and to the more intensive exploitation of the lands and mines already in use. Even if population did not grow, diminishing returns would still be encountered in mining, as the ores closest to the surface and otherwise easiest to work gave out. In the case of mining, diminishing returns actually accompany the repetition of the same amount of labor over time, not just the application of additional labor at the same time. Thus, even with a constant population, in the absence of economic progress, the standard of living falls rather than remains stationary. When it does remain stationary, it does so as the result of at least enough economic progress taking place to offset the operation of the law of diminishing returns in mining. These facts should be of significance in judging the proposals of those who desire an end to economic progress, notably the ever-increasing numbers within the environmental or ecology movement who subscribe to the goal of zero economic growth. What they are asking for is not the maintenance of our present level of well-being, but growing impoverishment. Furthermore, it should be realized that such impoverishment cannot be made gradual and gentle, as year-to-year diminishing returns in mining might suggest. Nor is it possible somehow to arrange for just enough economic progress to offset diminishing returns in mining. Economic progress is not something that can be controlled or regulated in amount. If the conditions are right for it, there is no fixed limit to how much of it there can be at any time. If the conditions are wrong for it, there will not only be no economic progress, but radical economic decline. The essential precondition for economic progress is the existence of individuals who are motivated to think and to apply the results of their thinking to the economic world. But this is also an essential precondition of the maintenance of any modern economic system as well. To maintain such a system, new problems must constantly be solved. Even if essentially the same problems have been solved before in previous generations, they are new to those who must solve them in the present generation. And almost always they will differ in at least some important respects from the problems solved in the past. All machinery and equipment eventually wear out and must be replaced. All buildings, roads, bridges, and tunnels sooner or later need total replacement or such extensive maintenance and repair as to be tantamount to total replacement. All of this requires a fresh process of thought, and this requires the existence of a large body of individuals willing and able to think. The attempt to stifle fresh thinking, that results in economic progress, must, if successful, also stop the fresh thinking that is necessary to maintain the economic system at its present level. This is because it must operate against fresh thinking as such. One cannot tell a self-activating intelligence that it can be driven by its curiosity up to the point of repeating what happens to be the old, but must not undertake the new. There is no way to distinguish between the fresh thinking that is necessary to replicate the old and the fresh thinking that gives rise to the new. If the curiosity and discovery associated with the new are to be prohibited, it must serve as a prohibition on the curiosity and discovery required to replicate the old. The effect of prohibiting economic progress must be to make eager intelligence give way to passive stupidity throughout the economic system, and thus radically to undermine the economic system, not merely prevent its improvement. Our discussions of natural resources imply that the doctrine of conservationism is incorrect. Conservationism regards the existing supply of economically usable natural resources as nature-given rather than as the product of human intelligence and its corollary, capital accumulation. It does not see that what nature provides is, for all practical purposes, an infinite supply of matter and energy which human intelligence can progressively master, in the process creating a steadily increasing supply of economically usable natural resources. Conservationism does not see that the increase in the supply of economically usable natural resources is part of the very same process by which the ability to produce as such and in general is increased. Having no conception of the role of human intelligence in the creation of economically usable natural resources, and confusing the present supply with all the natural resources present in nature, the conservationists naively believe that every act of production that consumes natural resources is an act of impoverishment, using up an allegedly priceless, irreplaceable treasure of nature. On this basis, they conclude that the pursuit of self-interest by individuals under economic freedom leads to the wanton consumption of mankind's irreplaceable natural heritage with no regard for the needs of future generations. Once having arrived at the existence of this altogether illusory problem, the product of nothing more than their own ignorance of the productive process, the conservationists further conclude that what is necessary to solve this alleged problem is government intervention designed to, quote, conserve natural resources by restricting or prohibiting in various ways mankind's use of them. Ironically, the consequence of all such restrictions and prohibitions is waste, the waste of the one truly scarce factor of production, namely human labor. It is our labor and our time that are fundamentally scarce, not land or natural resources. It is our labor and our time that we fundamentally need to save, not land or natural resources. For the most part, we need to economize on land and natural resources only insofar as doing so represents a saving of our labor or time. We need to be concerned with those land sites and mineral deposits whose existence saves us labor, as compared with having to produce by using inferior land or mineral deposits. For example, we value farmland in the Midwest and an oil field because their existence saves us labor in producing food and oil. Without that Midwestern farmland, we would have to produce to a greater extent on less productive East Coast farmland, or cultivate our other Midwestern land more intensively, and thus produce with a lower productivity of labor. Similarly, without that particular oil field, we would have to resort to more intensive, less efficient methods of extracting oil from other such fields, or perhaps bring into production a less productive source of oil, such as tar sands or even shale deposits. In both cases, the effect would be that it would take more labor to produce the same amount of goods. The existence of the Midwestern land and of the oil field saves us that labor, and that is why we value both. Sometimes, it is true, particular land sites are unique in what they enable us to produce. Their product cannot be perfectly duplicated by using a larger quantity of labor elsewhere. For example, real estate in downtown Manhattan, sturgeon beds providing fine caviar, vineyards serving in the production of grapes and thus wines of a unique flavor. At other times, no amount of labor can provide more of a good. For example, agricultural commodities between harvests. In these categories of cases, we may speak of a problem of conservation apart from the saving of labor. But even in these cases, conservationism is thoroughly mistaken in thinking that some kind of political action is required to avoid misuse of the goods in question. This is because the market price of such goods reserves them to their most important uses and limits the rate of their consumption in conformity with the limited supply of them available. The free market price of real estate regularly ensures that it is devoted to its most important uses. The free market price of every agricultural commodity acts to conserve an adequate supply of it until the next harvest comes in. In exactly the same way, the free market price of minerals operates to limit their rate of consumption between the discovery of new deposits or improved methods of extraction, insofar as that may be necessary. In such cases, the prospect of higher prices in the future operates to bring about higher prices immediately, which higher prices automatically limit the rate of consumption. No limitation of the rate of consumption by the government is required. All the necessary limitation is effected by the free market price, which makes all due allowance for the needs of the future. Any limitation of the rate of consumption over and above that accomplished by the free market price merely serves needlessly to sacrifice the present to the future, which does not require such sacrifice, and thus simply to render human labor less productive. The mistaken philosophy of conservationism currently plays a major role in the opposition to atomic power, the strip mining of coal, and the opening of new landfill areas for garbage disposal. It also underlies the many proposals for recycling and even the 55-mile-an-hour speed limit. It is argued, for example, that the disposal of radioactive material from atomic power plants constitutes a major problem because the dump sites in which the material is placed will remain radioactive and therefore unusable for other purposes for tens of thousands of years. Similarly, it is argued that the strip mining of coal should not be undertaken because once the coal is removed, the land will no longer be usable for farming or ranching, unless at great expense the soil layer is restored. The supporters of these arguments simply do not realize that we do not need every last piece of land that we possess. In the United States, we have hundreds of thousands of square miles of land, deserts and mountains, for example, that as far as their contribution to human life and well-being is concerned, might as well be covered with seawater. The marginal utility or importance of such land is zero. Even if some of it were lost to use forever, it would make absolutely no difference to human life and well-being. In insisting on the sacredness of every square mile of land, we place ourselves in the position of a kind of irrational miser, not a miser of money, but, if it is possible to imagine it, a miser of water in a country that is filled with lakes, rivers, and streams. It is as though we were a farmer needing, say, 1,000 gallons of water a day for every purpose that water can serve, and having 10,000 gallons a day available, and yet losing sleep at night over the loss of a cupful somewhere. Even if out of the 3.5 million square miles of territory of the United States, atomic dump sites and surface coal mines totally and forever destroyed the usefulness of a few hundred or even a few thousand square miles for other purposes, there would be no loss to us. Even if some of the land to be used for these purposes presently has other uses, like serving as farmland or ranch land, these uses would be given up only because of the land's greater value as a dump site or mine. And its loss as farm or ranch land would be made good either by bringing other presently unused land into production or by producing more intensively on other land. To make all this concrete and as clear as possible, let us assume that a coal mining company wants to buy land in Wyoming that is presently a cattle ranch. It is willing to pay a price that is far higher than corresponds to the income its present owner can make from ranching. Neither the coal mining company, nor the rancher, nor the great majority of other people may realize it, but this higher offer reflects the fact that this piece of land is more urgently needed for coal mining than for cattle ranching. The buyers of coal are willing to allow more in the price of coal for the use of this piece of land than the buyers of cattle products are willing to allow for it in the price of cattle products. That is why it is worth more to the coal mining company than it is to the cattle rancher. Even if the piece of land is lost forever to cattle ranching or any other use thereafter, the effect is that we can obtain urgently needed coal and energy while the cattle the land previously supported can be fed on other land. Furthermore, because of the greater availability and therefore lower price of energy that would result from allowing the all-out development of energy sources, it is almost certain that the cattle would soon be able to be raised at a lower cost on other land than they could be if they continued to remain on valuable coal-bearing land. The same principles, of course, apply to atomic dump sites. It should go without saying that in a capitalist society, the owner of such a dump site would not be able to expose the property of his neighbors to harmful doses of radiation. He would have to own a large enough site to ensure that radiation levels at its perimeter were well within the zone of safety. Of course, it is probably the case that in the future, technology will find ways of eliminating radioactivity and restoring land at far less cost than is presently possible. Whether it does or not, however, is irrelevant, for nothing depends on our having the land in question. As matters now stand, the kind of mistaken ideas about the waste of land that have been discussed are threatening us with an enormous waste of our labor. This is because the only alternative to the energy that man-made fuels such as atomic power and strip-mined coal provide is the minuscule amounts that human muscles can provide. If we prevent the further development of such man-made fuels, then our ability to produce is correspondingly impaired. A further consequence of the conservation mentality has been a sharp reduction in the number of government permits issued for the opening of landfill areas for garbage disposal. The conservationist rationale is that the use of this land for this purpose represents a waste of the land. The effect has been that as the existing landfill areas approach their planned capacity, a shortage of space for garbage disposal has begun to develop. In response to this shortage, citizens are denounced for a profligate lifestyle, which allegedly generates an excessive amount of garbage, and as part of the solution, parents are urged to sacrifice both their own convenience and even the comfort and health of their infants by giving up the use of disposable diapers and going back to the use of diaper services. As the shortage of landfill space has developed, such facts as the government's restrictions on the opening of new landfill areas have been conveniently ignored in the press, which has led the public to believe that the problem is one of actual lack of space for garbage disposal, which it is certainly not. As I've said, confusions about waste are present in much of the concern expressed about the need for recycling. Of course, recycling sometimes is economically sensible. Whether it is or not is indicated by the relationship between the market price of the recycled material and the cost of recycling it. If the market price of the recycled material is high enough to allow compensation for the labor involved and for a competitive rate of profit on the capital that must be invested, then the recycled material is important enough to justify the recycling. For example, the price of gold and silver is high enough to make it pay dentists to retrieve the shavings drilled from fillings, which would otherwise simply be washed down the drain. On the other hand, it would normally not pay people to save their steel or aluminum cans, because the productivity of labor in mining fresh iron and aluminum ore is so high, and the price of iron and aluminum accordingly so low, as to make their efforts in this regard highly inefficient and unnecessary. When it is possible for a comparative handful of workers using giant steam shovels and other such machinery to move and process ores in multi-ton loads, and thus to produce things like new tin cans and glass jars easily and cheaply, it makes little sense for the average person to spend his time ferreting through his garbage to find a few cans or jars to bring to his neighborhood recycling center or to set aside for pickup by a special garbage truck. (Clears throat) It is not his throwing away the cans or jars that is wasteful, but his spending his time to retrieve and deliver them, or the garbage disposal companies having to make a separate collection of them. For he certainly has better things to do with that time, and the garbage company should not be put to the needless expense of having a second truck and crew to collect items of insignificant value. Nevertheless, many prosperous and supposedly intelligent American citizens have allowed themselves to be bamboozled into treating the saving of bits of garbage as more valuable than their time. And in the process, many of them have actually turned portions of their dwelling space into mini recycling centers, carefully separating newspapers, metal cans, and glass containers from ordinary refuse to make possible the convenient collection and recycling of these items. Well, not surprisingly, since you can't fool all of the people all of the time, the attempt to get people to accept such irrationality has begun to introduce what must be described as a measure of totalitarian coercion into people's lives. In a growing number of places, recycling has become mandatory. Where this has happened, as in New York City, there are now garbage police whose job is to snoop into people's garbage to make sure that they are complying with the recycling requirements. Such coercion and spying are unavoidable when people are required to do something nonsensical and which they would thus not do voluntarily, or at least many of them would not. It can be expected that as mandatory recycling becomes more widespread, school children indoctrinated with environmentalism will be encouraged to report neighbors and even their own parents to the garbage police if they see evidence that the recycling requirements are not being complied with. Well, in the question period, I'll be very glad to deal with such matters, with questions pertaining to such matters as the wastes entailed in the 55-mile-an-hour speed limit, and with the errors contained in such popular ideas about deforestation and the near extermination of the buffalo earlier in this century. I'd also be happy for an opportunity to deal further with the question of why patents and copyrights and intellectual property in general are not wealth. I've rushed a bit to provide more time for a question period today than yesterday. So just let me say in closing that in my next lecture on Saturday, I'll turn to environmentalism and its hostility to economic progress in depth, full scale. In preparation for that lecture and the one to follow, I'd very much like to ask you to read my pamphlet, The Toxicity of Environmentalism, if you have not already done so. A copy was distributed to everyone along with all the other materials you received at registration. Your reading of the pamphlet will enable me to cover more ground in my lectures and to avoid a great deal of unnecessary repetition for the large number of those of you here who have already read it. Well, thank you very much. Dr. Locke.
You might add to your list the desire of the government, of course, to save gas by buying smaller cars. It's one of the biggest threats to human life they've ever suggested, because smaller cars are much more dangerous when they get hit.
Right. I think everyone hears the point for the benefit of the tape audience. Dr. Locke makes the point that the government's efforts to force people to force the auto manufacturers to produce higher mileage automobiles requires the production of smaller cars, which are much more dangerous in collisions and therefore is a substantial cause of deaths. Yes, that's certainly true. This gentleman right here in the center.
Another flaw with recycling laws going out that assumes that once you throw something away, it's never recoverable. Correctly enough, at some point, you need to retrieve it, it's still there.
Is it another flaw of the recycling argument that if you throw something away, it's not recoverable. I'm not familiar with their having made much of that point, but that's certainly not correct. It's somewhere, hopefully in a garbage dump. Part of the problem, I think, comes from the fact the government owns the parks. And so the government is too incompetent and inefficient to keep them clean, and they're free, so people don't treat the property with any respect. There's no need to worry about the litter problem if we had private property with owners who were concerned with keeping it clean. That I think has a connection with the point you're making. Yeah?
Just a point to be made, in terms of the current technology, you gave the example of aluminum cans being efficient to recycle. It is much more efficient to recycle aluminum because it's such a high energy intensive product than it is to mine aluminum and produce it as a primary smelter grade. So it's really an incorrect example. The point, though, is that you've been making that it's very much correct, is that each rational individual has to determine the value of his time relative to the value of recycling a product in terms of the money derived from doing that, right, and make a judgment of whether you should do it or not.
The gentleman says that from his understanding, it is economically sensible to recycle aluminum because the amount of energy involved in making fresh aluminum is much greater than the amount required to recycle aluminum that's already produced. What you say perhaps is possible. I don't think the quantity of energy in question by itself could tell the story. It would depend on the cost of the energy. The fact that producing a new fresh aluminum might require a great deal more energy doesn't matter if the energy itself is not so costly. The guide would be, if there were a free market price of used aluminum cans that were high enough to make it worth people's while to return the cans, well, then that would be the way it would work. No legislation would be required. It would be the same thing as we don't need a law to tell dentists you must install a special catch to retrieve the precious metal fillings. I don't think, as on the basis of my experience, and I'm not an expert on this, I don't think that the recycling of aluminum is in fact economical, or that at least it would be economical without government intervention to compel it. I don't think the market would bring it about, but I could be wrong. This gentleman right here.
You mentioned that one of the problems in creation of wealth reduces to increasing productivity of labor, and I was wondering how you go about measuring something like that.
Well, how do you go about measuring the productivity of labor? Well, you could measure it in accurately in the case of specific individual goods, perhaps. If, for example, you were using the same kind of workers and you saw, well, here they could pack 20 pounds of books in an hour under one system and 200 under another, that's a higher output of the same kind per unit of labor. Now, where you have different types of labor, where you have different types of goods, you cannot measure it in a precise way, and it is not necessary to do so. For example, I think we can say with absolute confidence that the amount of wealth produced per capita in the United States is radically greater today than it was 100 years ago. Now, the average hour of labor, or the average work week that is performed in the United States today, allows the average person to have such things as an automobile, the modern wardrobe, the modern diet, contemporary living space, a television set, etc., etc. Now, could we say that today's dwelling is what multiple of the dwelling of 100 years ago? What is the ratio of one automobile to such and such amount of horse-drawn transportation? We cannot specify a definite number, but I think we can say with great confidence that it is vastly greater. It's not necessary to measure it to give a numerical figure on it. It's sufficient, and this is the best that we can do, and it is sufficient, to say the productivity of labor is larger, it is dramatically larger, it is stupendously larger. And that's the only kind of comparisons we really need to make. Mr. Coates.
With regard to the ineradicable scarcity of human labor and time,
yeah.
You addressed an objection that I've heard many times. It's sort of a science fiction scenario in which far in the future we have robots that can do just about everything. They can do manual labor, they work in the home, they do the mining, they just do about everything. And it wipes out, 90% of human labor and just leaves a few white collar type things and scientists and so on.
Mm-hmm. Well, then we'd be doing the type of that white-collar and scientific work. Now, you see, let me point out something. When you think of radical, dramatic advances, consider the production of a given product as divided into, let's imagine, two steps. Now, if we increase the productivity of labor, two equal steps, if we increase the productivity of labor in one of those two steps by a factor of 100, how much have we increased the overall productivity of labor? Roughly by double. If there are 10 steps in the production of something, and we wipe out the labor in 9 of the 10 steps, we've increased the productivity of labor by a factor of 10. You can think of all kinds of dramatic advances. Labor is always still essential. And as I say, if we had that kind of far future scientific society, well, in that society, the human population would be employed in the manipulation of such large numbers of these robots and other devices that's how we'd be jumping from planet to planet. This gentleman right here.
It's my understanding that the environmentalists claim that one of the reasons for recycling scarcity of dumping sites, that we are being inundated by garbage. To what extent does that claim have any validity?
I don't think it has any validity at all. As a matter of fact, the sites that are used are not even lost forever. The stuff is plowed under, and then later on, golf courses can be put over them, housing developments. You could make a comparable case, perhaps a I don't want to launch a new scare. Think of the problem of cemeteries. I think that's totally a nonsense issue. You could make some calculations. I attempted to do this. If you figure out how much garbage an average family generates in a week, and how many acres there are in a mile, and how much garbage fits into this, I think even if the dump sites were lost forever, in the United States, probably 10,000 square miles of land would be enough to contain each family generating a cubic yard of garbage per week for the next 10,000 years or something like that, or the next 1,000 years. This notion that we're running out of land for dump sites, and this is a real issue, that what are people in the year 7,000 going to do for land, and what about the atomic waste? There's actually an element of madness to this, I think. There are no significant problems. Whatever problems there might be, people who will come after us, who will know more than we will easily and readily solve them. This lady right here, yes? Okay. No, this can't be. We have till 10:30. I have 10 after. Okay. All right, you could have a negative marginal utility. A good example of that is if you badly overeat and have to throw up. Well, how would I reconcile that with a limitless desire for wealth? I would say we don't have a limitless desire for wealth of each and every individual type. Adam Smith stated it. He said, the desire of food is limited by the narrow capacity of the human stomach, but the desire of all these other things. So we will never have negative marginal utility from wealth as such, because if you think of what wealth represents, the application of wealth enhances the power of our limbs and our senses and our minds. It's the means by which we act upon the world, and it represents objects of experience. Well, negative marginal utility of wealth as such, I think, would be tantamount to negative utility of life. So, now, negative marginal returns, you mean negative output? Well, if you are producing in a highly inefficient way, like let's imagine you're crowding too many people into an automobile, and now two people are going to sit on top of the driver and the car will crash, well, then you've got to produce another car at some point. We don't have negative returns to labor as such if we have we don't even have a real problem with diminishing returns if we can have scientific and technological progress and people acting long range, and so they're accumulating capital. Yes, Mrs. Katowski, is it? Okay, thank you very much. I'll pay you later. Yesterday I talked about wealth and said wealth is material goods made by man. And when I discussed goods, I took for granted that the context was material goods. Now, it is also possible to apply a concept intellectual goods. Now, intellectual goods would embrace every true idea, every correct principle of any science. Economics does not deal in any significant or extensive way with intellectual goods. It acknowledges their existence and their vital importance to the production of material goods, but economics is a science which focuses on material goods, on wealth. It's not a universal science of the good. It's not even the sole science dealing with material goods. I think we could probably consider all or most of engineering as sciences studying the production of wealth. What is unique to economics is that it's the science which studies the production of wealth under a system of division of labor. That's what differentiates it from things like engineering. Now, intellectual goods are essential to wealth. Human beings are essential to wealth to provide their labor, but neither of them are wealth. They are fundamental requirements. Now, the legal institution of patents and copyrights encourages the discovery of new ideas. It promotes the development of new intellectual goods, and thereby indirectly encourages the production of greater wealth. But because patents and copyrights and the whole legal system of individual rights, a sound judiciary, a good constitution, division of powers, these are all things which underlie very essentially the production of wealth. None of these things are themselves wealth. Now, patents and copyrights are legal protections of intellectual property. But intellectual property, while essential to the promotion of wealth, is not wealth. It does have an economic value. It does have an exchange value. And the fact that it has an exchange value, a market price, that I think makes it a little more difficult to untangle its status. But I remind you, so do stocks and bonds. They're not wealth. They're claims to wealth. Now, ironically, what gives to patents and copyrights a market value is the fact that the holder of the patent and copyright has the right temporarily to limit the amount of wealth that is produced by virtue of his intellectual creation. What makes a patent or copyright economically valuable, having a market price, is the fact that temporarily it allows the creator of the idea to hold back the increase in the amount of actual wealth. When the patent or copyright expires and anyone becomes free to use the new idea, then the supply of that actual kind of wealth increases. So it's of a very different character. The patent or copyright, even though it has a price, its price exists by virtue of the legal ability it gives to the holder to limit the production of wealth. Its economic price rests on a limitation of the production of wealth, not on the fact that it itself is wealth. It is not wealth. Thank you for the question. I hope this clarifies matters further. Yes?
Yeah. Could you discuss the fallacies in the view that deforestation is harmful?
Okay, the fallacies in the view that deforestation is harmful. Well, what I really want to refer to is the notion that under capitalism, private individuals engage in uneconomic, destructive deforestation. There could be a situation in which deforestation could be harmful if we had a mad government which decided, you know, if Woody Allen were writing a script, the same guy who was requiring everyone to learn Swedish in Cuba might decide to cut down all the trees. So that could be economically harmful. But such a thing does not occur under capitalism. There was uneconomic deforestation in the late 19th and early 20th century by logging companies, but it went on because the land was not private property. If forest land were private property, then trees would be regarded as a long-term crop, and replanting would occur automatically anytime the prospective price of trees exceeded the cost of the replanting by enough to provide the compound competitive rate of profit over the period of time necessary. But it's a radically different story if the government owns the land and it says, okay, you have the right to come in and cut down the timber, and then we'll see 20, 30 years from now, it'll be up for grabs again, who will have the right to whatever timber is here then. If we ran agriculture that way, the farmers would harvest the crops and they wouldn't replant because they wouldn't know who would get the benefit of the replanting. So the solution in the case of deforestation of an uneconomic kind is private ownership of the forests. And there you'd have an encouragement not only to replanting, but to replant, to deliberately developing trees which would grow faster and be just as good. Okay, now it's 10 minutes. Mr. Oliver.
Could you elaborate on why 55 miles an hour is wasteful?
I'm sorry?
Could you elaborate on why 55 mile an hour speed limit is wasteful?
Okay, thank you for that opportunity. Why is the 55 mile an hour speed limit wasteful? It wastes the labor of truck drivers, the equipment of trucking companies, and the time of ordinary drivers. See, just think about the fact it's true, or I assume it is true anyway, that if you drive 55 miles an hour, you can cover the same distance with less fuel than if you drive at 65 or 70. Now, every trucking company has known this for God knows how long. Why do they refuse to make this saving? Well, if you're going to haul freight at 55 instead of 70, it takes you 70/55 the time to carry the same freight the same distance. And you need more truckers' time, and you may need more trucks. So they have to weigh against the saving of the money in fuel. the extra expense of the wages of the truckers' labor and the cost of additional equipment. And they follow that policy, which achieves the lowest overall cost. And in that way, they are considering every relevant thing. To make them go slower is to make them use unnecessary labor and equipment. And to make ordinary drivers go slower, well, people know they could save a few dollars a month or whatever, but they value their time more highly than the saving of the money. Now, a further fact, since we could produce more oil, we have the ability to produce more oil by devoting more labor to it. If you had a situation where you can save $5 worth of oil by driving slower, but it costs you $10 more in other costs to achieve that $5 of saving, the implication is almost certainly that to save the labor required to produce $5 worth of oil, you're expending the labor required to produce $10 worth of other things. You're wasting labor.
There's this a long time ago, I did a calculation where there's another consideration, too. You're also burning gas for, let's say, 75ths of the time longer, and if the drag coefficient in the vehicle is low enough, you won't even be saving gas. You'll be burning more gas because you're burning it for a longer period of time on the road.
Well, it might be, but I don't quite follow that right now. But it's an added... Okay, well, perhaps it doesn't, but I mean, on the assumption that it did, it wouldn't really matter. Right. This gentleman right here in the center.
Tell me about the buffalo.
Tell you about the buffalo. Okay, buffalo obviously could have been domesticated and raised on ranches. And you have to ask the question, why didn't anybody do this? And the explanation is, the price that could be obtained for buffalo meat and buffalo hides did not cover the costs of the operation by enough to provide a competitive rate of profit. Now, why didn't they? Because people much preferred to have beef and cow hides. Now, to preserve the buffalo as they were would have required either that we ram buffalo down people's throats in place of beef, which they prefer more, or perhaps that we close the Great Plains or some substantial part of them to economic development. Now, that would have been very, very wasteful. The buffalo were of value only so long as they were there freely for the taking by cowboys and pioneers passing through. It would have been a radical inefficiency either to close off a major portion of the country needed to grow crops or raise cattle or whatever, or to make people consume buffalo instead of beef. That would be what actually occurred was the rational outcome. To have prevented it would have been the waste. Mr. Kearns, I believe? No.
On the question of wealth, definition of wealth,
yeah.
If you were living in Alabama in 1850, would you consider slaves to be wealth?
Well, thank you very much for asking that question. I didn't even suggest that one. That's an excellent question. If I were living in Alabama or the South in the pre-Civil War era, would I have considered slaves to be wealth? I would say that from the perspective of the slave owner, slaves had the appearance of wealth, but they were actually a form of pseudo-wealth whose economic effect was to prevent the acquisition of equivalent real wealth. I would say the fact that the South had the institution of slavery was directly responsible for the South being vastly poorer and much more backward than the North. And you could see it in this way. Imagine, on the one hand, we have a Northern factory owner who has 500 employees in his factory. And somewhere in the South, we have a slave owner with 500 slaves. And both of these men is worth $1 million. Now, the northern factory owner, when he calculates his $1 million, his $1 million is represented by his factory and all the machines. Now, he's got 500 workers there, but he doesn't count his 500 workers as any part of his wealth. The southern plantation owner has his 500 slaves, and that basically is his $1 million, and there is no actual wealth. If the South had not had slavery, then for people to be rich in the South, they would have had to own actual physical wealth and not counted them rich merely because of the presence of human beings. So I would say, generalizing from that kind of example, in making the presence of human beings into a form of pseudo-wealth, one displaces the accumulation of equivalent actual capital. One keeps the area capital poor. So that's why the South, a major reason for the South being economically backward. We have time for what, one or two more? Two more? Two more. Okay, this gentleman right here in the middle.
What's the solution to the so-called water crisis or water shortage?
Here in Southern California?
Yes.
What is the solution to the so-called water crisis in Southern California? I would say the permanent long-run solution is to have the private supply of water. If we had a private water supply, you could imagine a wholesale water market where prices would be determined by the availability of water in different parts of the country. You could have systems interconnected essentially as the electric power grids are interconnected. There'd be a wholesale market price for water. And anytime an area was growing in population and there was some tendency for demand to get a little ahead of the supply, it would become economically worthwhile to construct additional pipelines. It would be profitable to do so. And if you had a price of water, it would be a very low price. The wholesale price would be extremely low. The retail price of water would basically equal the minimal wholesale price plus an allowance for the costs of the pipeline and a competitive rate of profit on the necessary investment. And the price of water would limit the rate of consumption to some degree. You wouldn't have a situation where, as it's claimed, people in California are growing the kinds of crops that you would need to have monsoons for to economically justify, because water is virtually given away. So I don't think we would have any more problem with water than we have with bread or any other normal good if it were supplied privately. Yes, this gentleman right here, the last question.
Does it make any economic sense at all to recycle paper?
Does it make any economic sense?
Yeah.
Does it make any economic sense at all to recycle paper? I can't give an answer to that question as an economist. You see, the market would decide such a thing. If there is some kind of need for used paper, which makes its price high enough so that there are people who find it economically worthwhile without any coercion of the government to go and collect it, then it would make sense. Sometimes it might, sometimes it might not. Let me just caution you in closing, an environmental safety warning about recycled paper. Don't use recycled paper in your microwave oven because it contains little bits of metal, and that's a good way to start a fire. In the efforts at recycling, I don't think that's been pointed out. Okay. Well, with that caution, thank you.